The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia. My name is Laura Kovacs, and I am honored to introduce our guest this evening. The 24th United States Poet Laureate, Ada Limone is acclaimed for her explorations of the frightening mysteries and hopeful uncertainties of the everyday. Her many poetry collections include the National Book Critics Circle Award winner, The Carrying, Bright Dead Things, a finalist for the National Book Award, and Big Fake World, winner of the Pearl Poetry Prize. She is also the host of American Public Media's podcast, The Slowdown. Her new collection is The Herding Kind. Please join me in welcoming Ada Limone to the Free Library.
Hello. Hello and welcome. Thank you for being here. Despite the rain, the storms, the date change, there was a lot we gave you. So I appreciate you making it out. Come in, come in. There's room, there's time. It's such a pleasure to be here in a library as a representative of now one of the largest libraries in the world, the largest library in the world, the Library of Congress. So it's a gift. Big fan of libraries. I think tonight what I'll do is, I think 12 poems, and that'll give you some idea of how the evening will go, so you can count down excitedly if you're ready to leave. Or you can be happy that there are more poems to come. And then we'll do a little Q&A. So yeah. So I'm going to begin with this poem, which is a poem I wrote about my stepfather. And it's called A Good Story. Some days, dishes piled in the sink, books littering the coffee table, are harder than others. Today, my head is packed with cockroaches, dizziness, and everywhere it hurts, venom in the jaw, behind the eyes, between the blades. Still, the dog is snoring on my right, the cat on my left. Outside, all those red buds are just getting good. I tell a friend, the body is so body. And she nods. I used to like the darkest stories, the bleak snippets someone would toss out about just how bad it could get. My stepfather told me a story about when he lived on the streets as a kid, how he'd some nights sleep under the grill at a fast food restaurant until both he and his buddy got fired. I used to like that story for some reason, something in me that believed in overcoming. But right now, all I want is a story about human kindness. The way once, when I couldn't stop crying because I was 15 and heartbroken, he came in and made me eat a small pizza he'd cut up into tiny bites until the tears stopped. Maybe I was just hungry, I said. And he nodded, holding out the last piece. I think that we often think about how profoundly our lives have been affected by those that have raised us. And when you were raised by someone who's experienced houselessness for a long time, it seeps into your being. And my stepfather, as a teenager, was without a home for a long period of time. I'm going to read a poem from my stepmother of 26 years who passed away in 2010. It's also about one of my favorite plants. Forsythia. At the cabin in Snug Hollow, near McSwain Branch Creek, just spring, all the animals are out, and my beloved and I are lying in a bed in soft silence. We are talking about how we carry so many people with us, wherever we go. How even when simply living, these unearned moments are a tribute to the dead. We are both expecting to hear an owl as the night deepens. All afternoon from the porch, we watched an eastern towhee furiously build her nest in the untamed forsythia, with its yellow spilling out into the horizon. I told him that the way I remember the name forsythia is that when my stepmother, Cynthia, was dying that last week, she said lucidly but mysteriously, "More yellow." And I thought, yes, more yellow. And I nodded because I agreed, of course, more yellow. And so now, in my head, when I see that yellow tangle, I say, "Forsythia, forsythia, 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 more yellow." It is night now, and the owl never comes, only more of night and what repeats in the night. The last time I was here in Philadelphia, there was forsythia blooming everywhere. And I thought it was a sign. And I love Philadelphia. It's a great city. And I have this feeling every time I'm here. It's interesting. There's a little magical element to this place. I'm going to read a poem. It's funny. I just passed a poem. I was like, do I want to read the dead bird poem? And then I was like, no. I don't want to read the dead bird poem. Instead, why don't we read about something that's alive? So what about a sexy tree poem? I mean, trees can be sexy, right? It begins with the trees. Two full cypress trees in the clearing intertwine in a way that almost makes them seem like one. Until at a certain angle from the blue blow-up pool I bought this summer to save my life, I see it is not one tree, but two. And they are kissing. They are kissing so tenderly it feels rude to watch. One hand on the other's shoulder, another in the other's branches like hair. When did kissing become so dangerous? Or was it always so? That illicit kiss in the bathroom of the four-faced liar, a bar named after a clock. What was her name? Or the first one with you on the corner of Metropolitan Avenue before you came home with me forever. I watch those green trees now, and it feels libidinous. I want them to go on kissing without fear. I want to watch them and not feel so abandoned by hands. Come home. Everything is begging you. That was an early pandemic poem. My husband was traveling a lot for work, and it did feel like everywhere I looked, there were sort of this idea of these couples and meeting places, and I was pretty alone. This is another poem that was written around that same period of time. Banished Wonders. The American linden sways nonplussed by the storm, a bounce here, a shimmy there, just shaking like music, left over from the night's end, wafting into the avenues before sleep. I remember once walking down Clinton Street and singing that line returning, New York is cold, but I like where I'm living. There's music on Clinton Street all through the evening. And of course, there was music, though it was me and my incessant remembering. And here, now, what does one even offer? Darling cockroaches of the highest order, hard underthings of hard underworlds, I am utterly suspicious of advice. What is the world like out there? Are you singing in the tunnels? I should say nothing sometimes. I should say memory will leap from the mountain. Dearest purple spiderwort in the ditch's mud. How did you do it? Such bravery, such softness. Even with all that name-calling and rage. No one wants to be the pretty thing all the time, but no one wants to be the weed. Alone, in Argentina, in a cafe, I never felt like dancing. I screwed up my face so it said nothing and no one and never. Borges lost his sight over years, and yet sometimes it's best to be invisible. What is it to be seen in the right way, as who you are? A flash of color, a blur in the crowd, something spectacular but untouchable. And now the world is gone. No more Buenos Aires or Santiago, no tango, no samba, no more pisco sour, sweet and sticky and piercing the head's stubborn brick. Mistral writes, we don't need all the things that used to give us pleasure. Still, some dense desire to sneak into the cities of the world, again, a window, to sit at Cafe Tortoni and refuse an invitation because I can. Now, we endure. Endure time, this envenomed veil of extremes, loss and grief and reckoning. Mistral writes, I killed a woman in me, one I did not love, but I do not want to kill the longing woman in me. I love her, and I want her to go on longing until it drives her mad, that longing, until her desire is something like a blazing flower, a tree shaking off the torrents of rain as if it is simply making music. I thought I'd read a poem about friends, about friendship. It's also about praise and how we praise each other, the language we give to one another. I feel very lucky to have a strong community and strong dear friends, some of whom are here tonight. Of course, I say it's about friends, but then it's also about a bird. But it's not a dead bird, because we skipped that one. So we're good. The magnificent frigate bird. Is it okay to begin with the obvious? I am full of stones. Is it okay not to look out this window, but to look out another? A mentor once said, you can't start a poem with a man looking out a window. Too many men looking out a window. What about a woman? Today is a haunting. One last orange on the counter, it is a dead fruit. We swallow dead things. Once in Rio near Leblon, large seabirds soared over the vast South Atlantic Ocean. I had never seen them before. 8-foot wingspan and gigantic in their confident gliding, black with a red neck like a wound or hidden treasure, or both. When I looked it up, I learned it was the magnificent frigate bird. It sounded like that enormity of a bird had named itself. What a pleasure to say, I am magnificent. And two, they traveled as a team, so I wondered if they named each other, generously tapping one another's deeply forked tail or their plumage glistening with salt air, their guller sacks, saying, you are magnificent. You are also magnificent. It makes me want to give all my loves the adjectives they deserve. You are resplendent. You are radiant. You are sublime. I am far away from tropical waters. I have no skill for flight or wings to skim the waves effortlessly like the wind itself. But from here, I can still imagine rapture, a glorious caught fish in the mouth of a bird. I thought maybe since we went from the bird to the fish, I maybe should read a fish poem, although it's a little sadder. I think this is number 6. I think. The first fish. When I pulled that great fish out of Lake Skinner's mirrored double surface, I wanted to release the tugging beast immediately. Disaster on the rod. It seemed he might yank the whole aluminum skiff down toward the bottom of his breathless world. The old tree of a man yelled to hang on and would not help me as I reeled and reeled, finally seeing the black carp come up to meet me, black eye to black eye. In the white cooler, it looked so impossible. Is this where I am supposed to apologize? Not only to the fish, but to the whole lake, land. Not only for me, but for generations of plunder and vanish. I remember his terrible mouth opening as if to swallow the barbarous girl he'd lose his life to. That gold-ringed eye did not pardon me. No absolution, no reprieve. I wanted to catch something. It wanted to live. We never ate the bottom feeder, buried by the rose bush where my ancestors swore the roses bloomed twice as big that year. That year, I killed a thing because I was told to. The year I met my twin and buried him without weeping so I could be called brave. So that's halfway through. This is a poem that's about, it begins with birds, and then it just takes an entirely different turn. And if you want to know, I did not know this turn was coming. So it was just as much as a surprise to me as it is to you. It's a prose poem, so it reads a little faster. Calling things what they are. I pass the feeder and yell, grackle party. And then an hour later, I yell, morning dove after party. I call the feeder the party and the seed on the ground the after party. I'm getting so good at watching that I've even dug out the binoculars an old poet gave me back when I was young and heading to the Cape with so much future ahead of me, it was like my own ocean. Tufted titmouse, I yell. And Lucas laughs and says, thought so. But he's humoring me. He didn't think so at all. My father does the same thing, shouts out at the feeder announcing the party attendees. He throws out a whole peanut or two for the Stellar's Jay who visits on a low oak branch in the morning. To think there was a time I thought birds were kind of boring. Brown bird, gray bird, black bird, blah, blah, blah bird. Then I started to learn their names by the ocean. And the person I was dating said, that's the problem with you, Limone. You're all fauna and no flora. And I began to learn the names of trees. I like to call things as they are. Before, the only thing I was interested in was love, how it grips you, how it terrifies you, how it annihilates you and resuscitates you. I didn't know then that it wasn't even love that I was interested in, but my own suffering. I thought suffering kept things interesting. How funny that I called it love, and the whole time it was pain. I'm going to read this poem for safety, the idea of safety. I wrote it after a dream that the poet Aracelis Gourmet had about me. And then she sent it to me and I said, now I've turned it into a poem. And this is what happens when you are friends with poets and artists. You can't help it. And if you're all in a room together and something good happens, you'll notice that we all say, it's mine. I'll take it. How we see each other. I forget I am a woman walking alone and wave at a maroon car, assuming it's a neighbor or a friend. Then the car circles the block and goes past me five times. One wave and five times the car circles. Strangers. It is the early evening. The firefly is not yet out. I trick the hunting car by pretending to walk into a different house. I am upset by this, but it is life, so I make dinner and listen to a terrible audiobook on Latin American literature that is so dull it's Dove soap. Violence is done, and history records it. Gold ruins us. Men ruin us. That's how the world was made, don't you know? A group of us, to tune out our grief every week, are watching dance movies. Five women watching people leap and grind. Every time I watch the films, I cry. Each week, even though we are hidden from each other by distance, I know I am the first to break into tears. Something about the body moving freely. Someone lifting it, or just the body, alone in movement, safe in the black expanse of stage, the body as rebellion, as defiance, as immune. Arasalis writes to tell me she had a dream where I am in Oaxaca, wearing a black dress covered with animals. In her dream, I am brushing my hair with a brush made out of animal hair. There is a large mirror and a room full of books. History comes at us through the sheen of time. I write back, was it ominous or was it hopeful? She says, the word I am thinking of is strong. I kindle the image in my body all day, the mirror, the brush, the animals, the vast space of the imagination, the solid gaze of a woman who has witnessed me as unassailable, the clarity of her vision so clean, I feel almost free. I know you had a sports game last night. That's what I call it. I have friends that call it sports ball, just whatever it is. She says, are you watching sports ball? I was like, I don't know. There's so many sports balls on. But this is a poem about sports. It is not about the Eagles. But it's also not about the Cowboys, so that's okay. It's a poem that I thought was about sports, and my friend Jericho Brown helped edit it and said, this is not about sports. But as a rebellion, I have still kept the title, and it is called Sports. I've seen my fair share of baseball games, eaten smothered hot dogs in Kansas City and carne asada burritos in San Francisco in the sunny stands on a day free of fog. I've sat in a bar for hours watching basketball and baseball and the Super Bowl, and I've even high-fived and clinked my almost empty drink with a stranger because it felt good to go through something together, even though we hadn't been through anything. But the drama of a game, it's players. If I'm honest, what I love, why I love, the sounds of the games, even when I'm not interested, half listening, is one thing. When my father and my stepfather had to be in the same room, or had to drop my brother and me off during our weekly move from one house to another, they, for a brief moment, would stand together in the doorway or on the gravel driveway, and it felt like what true terror should feel like. Two men who were so different, you could barely see their shadows attached the same way. And just when I thought I couldn't watch the pause lengthen between them, they'd talk about the playoffs or the finals or whatever team was doing whatever thing required that season. And sometimes they'd even shrug and make a motion that felt like two people who weren't opposites after all. Once I sat in the car and waited for one of them to take me away, and from the back seat, I swear, they looked like they were on the same team, united against a common enemy, had been fighting all this time on the same side. is true. I think I'm just going to read 3 more poems, which is 1 more poem than I told you. Forgive me. I never read this poem out loud, and I think it would be interesting, because I don't know if I have read it to an audience before. I always think that's kind of fun to do something like that. And I just said, forgive me, and this poem is called Forgiveness. It was the winter of manatees. Captain Rhonda and her chartered pontoon boat floating down the Crystal River. It was the winter you hurt me, and that day of dumb hearts where you brought me truffles and perfume like a performance. At the tiki bar in the cold February Florida wind, Rihanna played over the staticky speakers hidden behind a fake coconut. Something about giving up or saying something. At the restaurant later, the couple we laughed at in their late 50s for maybe being swingers. All the uniformed tables, identical roses and cheap plastic vases. Even my deep cleavage and the layer cake were trying too hard. Still, we committed to the event of us and made a joke about not hurting each other again. We weren't married yet. Everyone was free to leave. And the next afternoon, you went to work and I took a boat down the river to see the manatees. It was back when I got lonely often. I called and asked if I could bring my dog on the boat. I couldn't. So tranquil and patient, the manatees moving, so many mysteries, even in the shallow water. Captain Rhonda showed us their hideous, their shadow places. People took pictures and pointed, and you could see the scars on the older animals from propeller blades, and still they rolled on together in the silent water. Back on shore, you found me by the too cold pool, watching a group of loud teenagers drink in the hot tub. One shirtless boy kept flexing and flexing, while the girls, engrossed in conversations, never noticed. And aren't we all alone in the end? You put your head for a moment against my chest. Then all I could hear was our breathing. We were both human and animal-hearted, bound to the blades, bound to outrun them. Okay, well, I read that one. And then I'll just do 2 more. This book is dedicated to my stepfather, who is a dear, wonderful man and an editor that I admire. And I also don't read this poem about him very often, but this is about him. What is handed down? Smoke and sweat seeped through your waiter's vest. And nights off, you'd play the harmonica on the rooftop. A man made out of netting and wire with an unexpected tenor, made of push-ups and the sound of typewriter keys, 8 tracks and knowing all the lyrics to all the songs. I thought you were a celebrity, the way people shouted your name when we walked through the plaza. Even as a child, I noticed your gentle way of fixing. The first time I saw it, it felt like a trick. The spider plant I killed because I didn't care enough about lives other than my own was soaked in the apartment sink until it came back to life. My mother's clock radio you took apart and put back together, good as new, though the war made it so you couldn't hear the high notes. It's selfish, I know, but I want to be the fixer now. Show me how you did it all those years. Took something that needed repair and repaired it. And then I'll close with this poem, which is a poem that I wrote in the beginning of the pandemic when I felt like I was sort of abandoned by poetry on some level. And I didn't know how to get back into it. And so I basically kept thinking to myself, well, I write a poem about this. And then I was like, ugh, no. And then me sort of refusing all those subjects became a poem. And I'm reading it also because my husband just had a high school friend message him on some social media and say, I don't get your wife's poetry at all. And he was specifically talking about this poem. And then my husband, who's never really been asked to explain poetry, was really trying to explain it. And I was like, I'm just going to leave that up to you. You just have fun with that. But I was so appreciative that he was taking the time to do that at all. The end of poetry. Enough of osseous and chicory and sunflower and snowshoes, maple and seeds, samaran shoot. Enough Kyuskuro, enough of thus and prophecy and the stoic farmer and faith and our father and tis of thee. Enough of bosom and bud, skin and God not forgetting and star bodies and frozen birds. Enough of the will to go on and not go on, or how a certain light does a certain thing. Enough of the kneeling and the rising and the looking inward and the looking up. Enough of the gun, the drama, and the acquaintance's suicide, the long-lost letter on the dresser. Enough of the longing and the ego and the obliteration of ego. Enough of the mother and the child and the father and the child, and enough of pointing to the world, weary and desperate, enough of, can you see me? Can you hear me? Enough, I am alone and I am desperate. Enough of the animal saving me. Enough of the high water. Enough sorrow. Enough of the air and its ease. I am asking you to touch me. Thank you. I'm happy to answer questions or evade them.
Hi. Just before you read that last poem, you said that you felt abandoned by poetry. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that as opposed to that you felt like maybe abandoning poetry.
Mm. Yeah, I was very much had the desire to write. I wanted to write. And I was reading poetry, but every time I thought about actually writing poetry, it felt useless. And I think, as many of us have found in the last 3 years, so many times, right? Whether it's the climate crisis, the pandemic crisis, you know, the war in Ukraine, whatever it is that's upon us, there are moments where we feel entirely useless. And I've always thought, oh, at least I can do this. And I think I had a moment where I thought, even that's not enough, even that little thing. But then, of course, in my sort of anger at my own poetic topics, I wrote that poem, and that poem actually brought me back into the, not just the wonder of poetry, but the sonic quality and how really it's the music that can save you, even if it's not hopeful or even if it's not an uplifting feeling. What it is really is the music itself. And I think that's when I realized poetry had not abandoned me. In fact, it had saved me. Yeah.
Hi, thank you for your poems. I'm wondering if there was ever a point in the beginning of your writing career where you felt your poems weren't going to be good enough. And if so, how do you get through that? How do you push through that as a writer?
Yeah. I mean, I think there are moments still that I wonder if my poems are good enough. I think after I write a poem, I think, you know, if I like it, I get very excited about it. I have two things. I have like a, I either immediately send it to the New Yorker and then immediately regret it because it's all full of typos and, you know, completely too fresh to be seen by anyone, you know, or I think this is terrible, I should never write again. So it's like I feel like I don't have the, you know, I have a very much, my whole work is I think about like trying to find some equanimity with those two experiences. But I do think that what I do now and very often is I think about a couple quotes, and one of them, of course, is that wonderful Jane Smiley quote, who always said, all the first draft has to do is exist. And I think, you're right, that's what it does, right? It just has to exist. It doesn't have to be perfect, doesn't have to come out done, and it might take years to finish. And then I think about Robert Haas saying, you can't revise nothing. And so I think, you know, I have to at least push through that part and get something down, and that's enough. And even if it's, again, never to be published or never to be seen, it's the act of doing it. It's the making that matters. And I try to give myself credit for that. I try to give myself love for that, because the making in and of itself, you know, daily, weekly, monthly, whatever it is, whatever your schedule is, will show you who you are over and over again, and that will deepen your work.
Hi, so I have like two craft questions for you. One being the like that the poem is an investigation of truth in some way, and I wonder if that's something that you maybe predetermined before you set out to write a poem, or if it's something you find along the way. Mm-hmm. And then my other question is kind of about authenticity, because your work is so vulnerable that often when I like, I've had a copy of The Carrying for a while, and there are moments where, you know, I feel like I'm almost reading something more of a memoir than a poetry collection. And so I wonder, like, how you feel about this, like, literary notion that, like, you know, the speaker of the poem is not necessarily the poet, right? And, like, how, you know, and the authenticity in that.
Yeah, those are two great questions. Thank you for that. I think the first question, when we talk about truth in poetry, I think it's very much about what is revealed to you. I think that if you start out with thinking, I'm going to tell a truth in a poem, that poem will never happen, you know. Or that poem, you know, someone may like it or you may like it, but there always may be something about it that you can't figure out. Why does this not work? And it's because you had a truth and you told it. And that's often a story, you know. That's not a poem. A poem at some point starts speaking back to you and says, oh, you thought we were going here. We're not going there. And that, like, when it becomes less about speaking to the page and it becomes about listening, that's where the truth arrives. And that's, I think, the most interesting and ethereal moment about making art, is that it feels like it's offering you something back. It's not about you speaking to the world. It's about you listening to the world. And then the second thing, in terms of authenticity, I mean, those are two questions. Authenticity and vulnerability, I think, are different. But I will say, being vulnerable on the page is still a craft choice. And I very much believe that I'm still controlling everything that's going on that page. Whereas if it were a journal, in a memoir you do the same thing, but if it were a journal, I would just write everything for the most part. Writing in a vulnerable way oftentimes does involve that listening. This is coming, so let me put it down there. But I'm still very much in charge of what that musicality is going to look like and what that breath is going to look like on the page. And so I feel like even though it is vulnerable, it is intimate, right? The act of sharing another poem is intimate because we're literally asking you to share breath because of the line breaks and the spade, you know? So that in and of itself is an intimate act, but I do think there's a level of craft and control in which if I were to be my most vulnerable self, it wouldn't be a poem, you know? It'd probably be me just, like, weeping, you know? Or laughing hysterically. You know, it would be something, to be the most vulnerable self would not be 100% making art. So the making art is always in there. So whether that's the speaker, you can call that, or whether it's the sort of translucent web that connects us all, and I'm sort of pushing through it, but I'm still pulling back enough to protect myself. That's still that craft. That's still the speaker. There's still a sheen. And that part is also about self-protection. You know, people will say, oh, you've told us everything. And I'm like, oh, no. No. So I think we're still in that in control. But I'm also I want to know how much I want to share and how much I want to pull back. And that's always part of the craft for me. Yeah. I could probably talk about that for hours, but yeah, thank you for that.
Hi, thanks for sharing your words with us. Mm-hmm. One theme that I think that I pick up on, at least in this collection, is the interconnectedness between yourself or the world, mm-hmm. and also a separateness from it as well. Mm-hmm. And so I'm curious if you could describe your relationship to solitude or mm-hmm. loneliness, mm-hmm. in particular, like to the world, to the natural world.
Yeah. That's another wonderful question. I feel very much that I have always been a little outside. I've always felt like I have been on the edges, which is funny because as a child was into performing and doing all those things, but I never felt like I belonged quite anywhere. And the place that I felt the most at peace and the most at ease was with nature, was in nature. And so that's still true for me. I've felt a wonderful sense of community, and I've built community and worked on community. And I think it's because there's a lot of people who have felt that way, you know? And then it was, suddenly you're a writer and you think, oh, well, we all feel that way. And so I think that my relationship to solitude and that sense of otherness has been less of something now that I have felt ill at ease with, and now something where I think, oh, that's my artist self. That's who she is. She's that person that maybe notices a little too much, you know, maybe feels a little too much. And there's a wonder in that. There's a gift in that. And that otherwise, to shut that down is to live in a numbness. And I've done that before too. But I think of my most tender self, my most receptive self, my weirdest self, as really the artist self. And therefore, when I do feel like that sense of isolation and separateness, I remember that it's not that. In fact, what it is a deep observation, and in some ways, a gift of listening in a different way, or looking in a different way, or watching in a different way, or even feeling in a different way. Thank you.
Your stuff is really great. Thank you.
Thank you.
I just was wondering if you find that your process of writing a poem is similar every time you do it, or does it change all the time? Mm. Do you do a draft and walk away for 48 hours and then come back and look at it every time? Or,
yeah.
You know, what's your process?
Yeah,
when you do
thank
it?
You for that. Thank you. It is different every time, and it surprises me. And I think that poets, and maybe even you know as a writer, like there's something that comes up that you feel like you sit down and you think you're writing something and you think, what even is a poem? And that happens to me still. Like, I'm like, how is this made? I don't know. I don't know how this is made. And so I think each time is very different. And sometimes it's like a certain thread will arrive and I know, oh, it's a launching pad and I'll follow it. And then sometimes I followed up to sort of a wild abundance, and in reality it shouldn't have gone on that long, or maybe it needed to go on longer. I tend to write first drafts fairly quickly, and then I will put those first drafts, or seeds, if you will, of poems, into a drawer, and almost wait about a month. I have a batch that I'll look at soon, from April, May, and June. I haven't looked at them since. And it just starts to be when a friend will be like, hey, do you have any new poems? And I'll think, I know I do, but they're not done yet. And so then I can go back and kind of look at what I've made and then craft it with a little bit more of a critical eye and maybe even more of a generous eye, depending on what it was that I was feeling at the time. So, but each one comes different. Sometimes it's a sound, sometimes if it's an image. It's very rarely an idea, you know? Like, I can't be like, I'm going to write it something about this. Like, I don't know quite how to do that. But it's usually beginning with some mystery or interest in language that I have. Thank you.
Hi, Ada. It's good to be in the same room as you. I was first introduced to your work, I think The New Yorker, The New York Times, maybe. Probably both at some point, huh? It was joint custody. Mm. And I really connected to that as somebody who grew up in a family that was separated. I felt quite fragmented, I will say. Instead of having two lives, it felt like I was, you know, also separated. But I was... And you have this common theme. You read one, sports, tonight. Mm-hmm. And I guess my question is, writing about this particular topic, did it shift your perspective of being in it? Did it become sort of a healthier perspective? Or how did it shift, I guess, as you started to write more and more about this topic?
That's wonderful. For those of you that don't know the poem "Joint Custody," it's about it's about having two households and going back and forth from my mother's house to my father's house. And the first line is, "Why did I never think of it as what it was? Abundance." And I think what happened was, for me, there's a lot of, with all of us, just unuseful stories, unhelpful stories that often we think we tell ourselves, but maybe they were told to us by the people that said, oh, it must be so hard that you are from a broken home, you know, or it must be so hard for you, or this must, and sometimes it might be very hard, right? But I think sometimes we hold on to those unuseful stories and unhelpful stories. And I think the pandemic, deep in the middle of it, I know we're still in it, but was a moment for me to kind of rethink those stories and question them. And, you know, like Lucille Clifton says, all poems start with questions. And I think it was me, like, interrogating what, like, broken home. Like, that's a weird thing to say. And I began to think about what it was to have, you know, four parents show up on student parent night and just be like, yeah, well, four of them. And I think that I just started to rethink how I wanted to view it. So I do think it helps me, because I think that, yes, do I think that I am fragmented in some ways? Or, I mean, even the poem ends, it says I have two different brains now, two entirely different brains. And I think that that could be seen as a problem. I could easily make that as like, oh, that's a problem. Or I could say, look at the skill I have to adapt. You know, I got to go from one household that was run by a elementary school principal, right? And a speech pathologist. You know, one household that was like a Mexican-American, you know, principal who you could imagine had a lot of rules. And then one household that was like, oh, hey, honey, throw your stuff everywhere, you know? So I can do that. And so now I think of it, that's like a gift too. That's something that I didn't know that I needed. But you know what? I have used that skill my entire life. And so I think for me, writing about those subjects is always interrogating what it was that not only someone else told you, but what you've been telling yourself has been a problem. And maybe it is a problem, you know? Or maybe it's actually time to lay some of that down and rethink it.
Hi, Ada. It's great to have you here.
Thank you.
Another process question. Can you talk a little bit about the nuts and bolts of your writing? Like, do you ever blurt in a journal? Do you drink a lot of coffee? Do you Do you read any particular people beforehand to get yourself in a zone, or do you avoid that? Anything about those real practical things?
Yeah, I love that. I'm always interested in people's processes. I once was talking to the great poet Fanny Howe, and she used to be very much a smoker, and she quit. And I said, oh, did it change your writing process? And she was like, yes, it changed everything about what I did. I was like, oh, I was just kind of asking her a casual question. But so I do think it's an interesting thing. I write in almost primarily in longhand in a journal. It does not have lines in it because sometimes I like to make terrible pictures. But also I feel like I get to make my own line breaks and figure that out. I do write in line breaks. Some poets write in prose and then decide where the line break is. For me, the line is my unit, and that's what I write in. I also used to think that I had to have a poetry journal that was separate from my journal of like to-do lists and things like that. But then I was like, no, this is all one life. And so now I actually have the blank journal. I open it up, I write the date, I set an intention for the day, and then I write my list of things that I need to accomplish. And then it's also my poetry journal, a dream journal, all of that throughout the day. And that has actually been really wonderful for me because now it just feels like it's all one thing. I have it with me all the time, and it feels like it's there's no like sort of poetry time and life time, right? It's all one. And then when I want to go and type something on the computer, I'll generally start to look at what I have. Oh, there was something interesting. Let me see if I can come back to it or bring it to the screen. But I like writing in longhand a lot. Yeah. So that's primarily that sort of nitty-gritty. I don't drink coffee. And I can't write after having alcohol. All I want to do, you know, if I have alcohol, all I want to do is hang out. You know, I don't want to. Do I read anyone beforehand? I think that there are times where just even one little glimpse of something will help me get into it. It was always a different poet. You know, there are times where I'm reading this same poet over and over again, but for the most part, I try to, like, pick up something and just read something, sometimes just to, like, you know, rejigger the brain a little bit and figure out what I'm going for. But I can't listen to music. Oh, yeah, Andy. Okay.
Hi. Wow, your poems really give me a great appreciation for the craft, but I was wondering if in your earlier life in your career as a writer, was there a moment when you knew this was going to be what you were going to do? Because I know there's a lot of aspiring writers here, and we're just having a lot of anxiety about this, but...
Yeah. Yeah, I love that. I feel that deeply. Don't you wish art and anxiety were like they couldn't enter the same room?
Yeah, thank you so much.
It was like, you have to go over there. But it, unfortunately, they are forever linked. And every time I'm making art, I'm like, oh, I didn't know anxiety was part of this. But I think it kind of is. And I'll say this, is that I think there were many moments that led to it. I know there was a moment when I found poetry, and I thought, oh, I want to do this. And I remember that when I read it. And then I remember the first time I wrote a poem that was actually pretty good. And I thought, oh, I want to make these. And that was in college. I was a junior and senior in college, undergraduate. And then it wasn't really like, even in graduate school at NYU, studying with some of the, you know, the foundational great poets, Phil Levine, Sharon Olds, Marie Howe, Galway Kinnell, Agashetta Lee, I think there was a big part of me that felt like, I still want to be able to do this. I don't think I know how to do this yet. And I had to get away from school a little bit. I had to get out of school. Like, they taught me how to craft a poem. They were phenomenal teachers. My thesis was poems that I knew that they would like. And that was kind of a problem. They did like my thesis. But I had to go and leave and be like, oh, what are the poems that I want to read? And a lot of those poems also were being, you know, the poems that were read out loud at, like, the readings and the bars and in community and with each other. And those are different poems than our workshop poems. And there are different poems that are like read in silence, you know, in the page. And I realized that I was a person that also worked in community and wanted to read poems that felt like they had life in them. And I think that shifted for me too. So there was just moments along the way, and I'll just say this, I know I've got to wrap up, but I think it's really important to think about longevity. Like the Buddhist monk Lama Rod Owen says, the goal is longevity. And you have to have that sense in your mind, because that making of the thing, the making of the art, has to be the thing that brings you the most joy. Because someone will tell you that it's not worth publishing, and someone will give you a bunch of praise. And those things are just going to happen. There's always praise and blame, as they say, right? So I feel like at some point you have to remember that this is just, I am going to make art, and I'm going to appreciate and be grateful that I get this opportunity to make art when so many people don't have that opportunity. And then also remember that not only is it about building community and not giving up, of course, but it's also about self-care, and it's also about figuring out how to make a living. Because I think that we don't talk about money enough as artists. I think very often we think, you just become an artist. We're like, okay, where's my tower? Like, where's my lunch delivered? I'm an artist, you know? And I think that actually your poems don't want you to be hungry. Your poems want you to be able to pay rent. And all of those things are part of making the life of an artist. They are not mutually exclusive. Your poems want you to make a healthy life for yourself. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like